From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. At 90, former U.S. Senator Joseph Tidings has fascinating stories to spin of growing up in a family both wealthy and politically connected. As a young delegate in Annapolis, Tidings was already irritating those in power in 1960 when he threw himself into campaigning for a presidential hopeful named Jack Kennedy. When Kennedy won, Tidings said he aspired to be named U.S. attorney.
He's not an ordinary prosecutor. He's a servant of the public. One of the parts when you're trained as U.S. attorney, it's equally important to protect the innocent as well as to prosecute those that are corrupt.
In a few years, Kennedy suggested he run for U.S. Senate. In his memoir, Tidings says his victory in 1964 was a blow to the political machine, all on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. People seem pretty fed up these days with politics, impatient with the gridlock and yet suspicious of compromises. Why don't they keep their promises? Why can't they get along and get something done? Maybe we need to hear how politics used to work in Maryland, how it's changed over the last seven decades, and how it hasn't. Joseph D. Tidings has laid it all out in a new memoir, the organizing, the campaigning, the friendships with the Kennedys that shaped his path to becoming U.S. attorney for Maryland and then U.S. senator, the dirty tricks that led to electoral defeat for both him and his father, and through it all, an optimism about the power of public service. The memoir is titled, My Life in Progressive Politics, Against the Grain, and Senator Tidings invited us here to his apartment in Washington to discuss it. It's good to see you, Senator Tidings.
Delighted to welcome you here. Delighted to visit with you.
And also with us is his co-author, former Baltimore Sun and UPI journalist John W. Freese. Morning, John.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Senator Tidings, before we get into the politics, let's talk about the coat of arms. Your maternal grandfather, Joseph Davies, was a friend and advisor to three presidents. He was U.S. ambassador to both Russia and Belgium.
Standing by to move into Germany when Germany invaded Poland in 1939.
So why does he come to have a coat of arms?
Well, the College of Heralds in Great Britain decided that he should have a coat of arms. And they gave him a coat of arms. It's a beautiful one with the watchword Integritas, which, as you know, means integrity. Well, Donald Trump, when he bought Mar-a-Lago, because my step-grandmother had a beautiful sign of Mar-a-Lago and had the coat of arms under it. Well, Donald Trump kept the name Mar-a-Lago, and he kept the coat of arms, except he took out Integritas and put in Trump, which is interesting because there is no integrity with Trump, but it created quite a row in Great Britain. And as a matter of fact, I had a group from Canada offer to put up any amount of money to sue Trump for doing this. I grew up on a farm. I worked on a farm every summer when I was a boy. And you don't get in a pissing duel with a skunk. That's rule number one if you work on a farm.
Let me back up a bit. The reason that your grandfather's coat of arms was at Mar-a-Lago was because your step-grandmother, Marjorie Merriweather Post, built Mar-a-Lago.
Absolutely. At the time she built it, Palm Beach was not the resort it is today. And as a matter of fact, going north, or I guess east from where Mar-a-Lago stands, was nothing but jungle.
Marjorie Merriweather Post was one of the richest women in the world, and there was other wealth in your family. You grew up wealthy.
I grew up blessed. I was adopted by my adoptive father, Miller Tidings. and I was always grateful for him. You know, when you're adopted, you're adopted. You owe a great deal to anybody who's willing to adopt you.
Tell us about your father, Miller Tidings.
He was a great military leader in World War I, and then he came back and ran for the House of Delegates, was elected, and then was immediately elected Speaker. He is the youngest Speaker in the history of the Maryland House of Delegates. 30 years old he was when he got back.
And then, of course, he went on to serve 4 terms in the U.S. Senate. We'll talk more about that later. You were following in your father's footsteps, serving in the Maryland House of Delegates, when you were first in contact with Jack Kennedy. Why did you want to support Jack Kennedy in the presidential race?
First of all, when I was first elected president of the Young Democrats, we put on each year in Baltimore a Jackson Day dinner. And when Jack Kennedy was elected senator and came down from Massachusetts, I invited him to be our speaker at the dinner, which was a big deal for the Young Democrats. I drove over to get him. Now, he's, I think, 11 years older than I, but he was sort of in a different league, different than I. And I was hugely, hugely, hugely impressed.
And you campaigned for him, obviously, in Maryland and several other states. After that election, the Kennedy administration offered you a position, and you said you wanted to be Maryland's chief federal prosecutor, the U.S. attorney. The Democratic political establishment in Maryland pushed back. Why and what happened?
Well, I was a reformer in the Maryland legislature. Maryland had no savings and loan regulation. We had some very corrupt savings and loan operations going on. I knew it. I had introduced legislation in the legislature, which was vetoed by the governor, which would require regulations of savings and loan. And I felt that we desperately needed cleaning up. And I felt that I could do the job. And the United States attorney, he's not an ordinary prosecutor. He's a servant of the public. I mean, one of the parts when you're trained as U.S. attorney, it's equally important to protect the innocent as well as to prosecute those that are corrupt. And I really wanted to be U.S. attorney. I wanted to learn how to try cases. And there were areas where I felt that the United States attorney could make a big difference in Maryland. So it was very important for me.
One of the things that happened in those days was that some of the leadership in the General Assembly were involved in the savings and loans, and they didn't want a guy like Joe Tidings, who wanted to regulate savings and loans, to become a federal prosecutor. I think they worried about themselves, and as things played out, they should have been worried about themselves.
That's right. Actually, before it was over, I prosecuted 2 Democratic congressmen, members of the House of Representatives. They were convicted. And the Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates, 1 state senator. There was a lot of cleaning that needed to be done.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with former U.S. Senator Joseph Tidings about his memoir, My Life in Progressive Politics, Against the Grain. Also here is co-author John Freese. There was a moment of what you call first-class legal theater. Tell us about that.
When you try a big case, there's a lot of attention on it, and there was a lot of attention on our case in the federal courthouse. I had brought over a lot of persons in Washington. I brought over Robert Kennedy's secretary and others, Assistant Attorney General, all of whom had been plagued by these two congressmen.
They had tried to pressure Attorney General Robert Kennedy to drop an indictment.
That's right, and to order me to drop the indictment. See, I was a U.S. attorney. And the Attorney General tells you to drop the indictment, you drop the indictment, because the Attorney General is chief federal law enforcement. In any event, we decided pull out all strings. We got the Attorney General himself to come to Baltimore to testify. And we smuggled him in to the federal courthouse. And then we had a brief morning recess. And we came back in. I said, the government calls Attorney General Robert Francis Kennedy. Well, my God, the courthouse exploded. That courthouse filled up like you wouldn't believe. Bobby was a magnificent witness. When that was over, the case was over.
You open your memoir with the scene of President Kennedy visiting your family home, Oakington, in August 1963. Why did he come?
Well, he came up because he wanted to discuss my running for the Senate. But I didn't know why he was coming, except he was invited, and I invited young people who were doctors, what have you. Not a single politician, elected politician, among them. So it was a very informal sort of dinner. And it was at that dinner that he asked me to come out in the next room. And when he told me he wanted me to run for the Senate.
Why did he want you to run for the U.S. Senate?
Well, he needed a few more Democratic votes to get legislation through.
One of the things that was happening in those days was that the Southern Democrats totally controlled the Congress, and particularly in the Senate. And President Kennedy wanted to get civil rights legislation through and some other issues like that, and needed the support of Democrats, more liberal Democrats. And I think he saw Joe Tidings as being one who would support those kinds of pieces of legislation, and of course he did.
You took President Kennedy's advice. You decided you would run for the Senate. You resigned as U.S. Attorney on November 21st, 1963. The next day, the president was assassinated. Did that...
Not the next day. That day, I resigned at 11:30, had a press conference, advised people I'm running for the U.S. Senate. And about 12:15 or 12:30, Frank Udall, the U.S. Marshal, came over and said, Joe, the president's been shot and killed.
Did that shake your resolve about running for U.S. Senate?
Well, yes. Yes. I wanted to run, but I had to sort of get my friends together, my supporters together, and determine whether or not I could run. And I knew it would be a very, very, very tough race.
The chapters on your 1964 campaign for Senate will fascinate political junkies. Let me summarize that in the primary, you handed Louis Goldstein his only ever political defeat. He went on to serve 10 terms as comptroller until he died in 1998. You frame this whole fight as you against the Democratic political machine in Maryland, and you frame your victory as a repudiation of the machine. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, wasn't your father, whom you adore, had he not been part of that machine?
Yes, but in a different sense. He was an independent leader when he was in the House of Delegates. There are many instances in the House of Delegates when he took on the whole house. This is before he went to war. I tried to model myself after him.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. I'm Sheila Cast, visiting with former U.S. Senator Joseph Tidings and his co-author John Friis. We're talking about their book, My Life in Progressive Politics, Against the Grain. Friis will be speaking about it Sunday evening at the Ivy Bookshop. When we're back, what's changed, what hasn't in politics? I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast, here in former U.S. Senator Joseph Tidings' Washington apartment to talk to him about his memoir, My Life in Progressive Politics, Against the Grain. His co-author, John Friis, is also with us. The cover photo is very intense. You're talking, or maybe about to say something, and over your shoulder, in softer focus, we see Robert Kennedy looking at you. And I wouldn't say he looks angry or he looks friendly. He is just watching you very carefully. Do you remember the setting?
Absolutely. We were both elected to the United States Senate the same year Lyndon Johnson was reelected president. And by circumstance, I was placed on a subcommittee and was senior to him on that subcommittee, to Robert Kennedy. He and I were very, 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 very close. And this was an issue involving shysters taking advantage of primarily poor African Americans. And I held the hearing and asked him to be there with me, which he was. We worked as a team.
In 1968, when he declared for president, you were campaigning for him. You saw him just a few days before he was assassinated. What did you talk about?
When he announced that he was running for the presidency, there was one other senator who said he would support him from the floor on that day, that is, his brother and myself. I was Robert Kennedy, through and through. I took off 60 days leave of absence from the Senate to campaign for him in 14 states, wherever he sent me. And I was campaigning for 2 days in Nebraska. We thought we had a chance. He was in Nebraska that night to speak to a big Democratic dinner, and we happened to cross paths in the airport. We sat down and we had 15, 20 minutes. And he looked at me and he said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. He said, I want you to look around and see how they treat Native Americans up here. And then when you get back to Washington, try and do something about it. So help me God, he said that.
You write, quote, when Bobby died, it seemed like the end. We continued to put one foot in front of another, but it was never the same after that. It must have been hard for you to continue in the Senate without him.
It was hard because when he won in California in the primary, I took 60 days leave in the campaign, and I was in California campaigning for him. The 4 or 5 days before the election, I came back to Maryland to vote in my own primary, and then to get waked up in the middle of the night or late in the night and told that he'd been killed. Very, very grim.
When it came time to run for re-election in 1970, there was an untrue story about you in Life magazine that turned out to have been planted by Chuck Colson, an aide to President Nixon. Tell us about that.
Well, I had been an officer, a shareholder, for many years in the Savings and Loan Association, which had done well.
The Life magazine article was intended to be a, quote, expose showing that Joe Tidings, who was sort of a model of integrity and transparency, actually was hiding work that he was doing for the savings and loan for his own benefit, and it wasn't true. And the whole thing was concocted by Chuck Colson and printed in Life, which even said in the article, essentially, we don't accuse Senator Tidings of doing anything illegal, but they were happy enough to smear him. And then it led to a follow-up story that Senator Tidings had somehow appeared on behalf of the savings and loan before the Federal Reserve Board, and that wasn't true either, and it took a series of stories. Every time they'd write about it, Senator Tidings would deny it, and they'd write another story.
Senator Fulbright, when it came out, at my request, had a full-scale Senate investigation of it immediately at my request. But the investigation was such that it had to be released by the administration, the Nixon administration, but which exonerated me on every step, but they wouldn't release it until after the election.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with former Senator Joseph Tidings and his co-author John Friis about his memoir, My Life in Progressive Politics Against the Grain. The National Rifle Association spent heavily against you in your 1970 campaign for re-election. Gun control is still a tough issue today. Why so difficult?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One is the National Rifle Association has a tremendous amount of money available, and they put it into races which are in areas where their candidate has a good chance of winning. They are absolutely unscrupulous in telling the truth about candidates running. And to date, no one has really challenged them effectively on where they are, how much money they're making, what they're getting out of it personally. I mean, the National Rifle Association leadership, president, what have you, I'm sure draw down salaries of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they have co-opted the Republican Party and moved the Republican Party into the National Rifle Association. When I was a senator, that was not the case. My last gun control legislation, I had four very fine Republican United States senators co-sponsors.
You close the book with an open letter to your grandchildren, and you identify money in politics, like the NRA money you were describing, as the major reason our system of democracy no longer works as it should.
First of all, I would not have written a book if I had no grandchildren. There would have been no book, period. I hope that they will, first of all, read the book, and then get out and try and do something in public service. And one of my grandsons is already committed to public service. He's going to go into the Peace Corps, and he's a brilliant kid. I expect my grandchildren to get involved in some type of public service. This is a great country, but we need idealistic young people who are interested in making the country better and stronger.
John, what would you add?
The issues that Joe Tidings dealt with 50 years ago are still all prominent issues today. Gun control, environmental protection, family planning, unpopular foreign wars, a solid, trustworthy judiciary. All those things are front and center today, and they're still difficult. And that I think is one of the reasons Joe was so interested in getting a younger generation involved in public service.
Thank you for this memoir.
Thank you for taking the trouble to interview me.
With John Freese, former U.S. Senator Joseph Tidings has written a memoir titled My Life in Progressive Politics, Against the Grain. Freese will be speaking about what went into writing the book on Sunday at 5 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road. We have a link to information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been with us this morning. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.